In my interview with Dr. Van Cutsem, I asked him about his thoughts concerning anti-PD-1 checkpoint inhibitors in MSI metastatic colorectal cancer outside of a trial setting.
Well, in Europe, we have a different healthcare system. In Europe, that would not be acceptable. We would have then to guide these patients toward a clinical trial, and the clinical trials are opening. So in the different regions, there are patients that, let's say, they can have access then to a clinical trial. We're talking only of a small group of metastatic colorectal cancer patients in this situation. In Europe, we are a bit more strict with what is on the label. It's not yet on the label of pembrolizumab, nivolumab, MSI patients, metastatic colorectal cancer, to treat them with these agents. But scientifically, let's say it like that, there is a rationale. And if a physician is fighting for his patient, could be a good way to look at, and especially to look at whether there is a trial in his neighborhood that is open to put the patient on a trial.
Oh, you know, I had that same impression, but it was interesting. I was interviewing Dr. Sals, you know, from France, and he told me about a patient with Hodgkin lymphoma that somehow they had accessed an anti-PD-1 agent outside a trial because, you know, the amazing results that they're seeing there. It kind of seems like this mismatch repair situation is almost analogous. It seems like you're seeing even more responsiveness than, say, you know, in lung cancer, melanoma. Is that your take? I know it's kind of hard to say with so many few patients.
Yeah, it's difficult to say, but in this trial published in New England, there was a third cohort of MSI non-colorectal cancer patients, and it included a various group of patients. So it's true. I don't know whether that's going to hold true for the whole story. For instance, if you look in gastric cancer, where there are some data also with pembrolizumab that were presented, in this study, the response rate was 22%, the external validated response rate. There were no data on MSI. And in colorectal cancer, one of the hypotheses of the MSI is that MSI tumors harbor more mutations, they are hypermutated. And there are tumors that are more or less hypermutated. And we have to see also in gastric cancer whether, let's say, the 22% of these patients who do respond, whether that are the MSI tumors, these data are not yet out in the public domain, and that is still to be established. But we will have an answer to these very interesting and very important questions within the next 6 or 12 months, I believe.
I saw that you had a paper in the British Journal of Cancer, Microsatellite Instable versus Stable Colon Cancers, Tumor Heterogeneity, Inflammation, and Angiogenesis. What did you learn from that?
Yeah, that's a recent paper indeed that our pathologist looked into that analysis, and that's more a pathological study. There are no direct implications in clinical practice, but what we see clearly also is that, especially if you look at immunohistochemistry, there is some heterogeneity in these tumors. Inflammation plays a role into that. It's a further learning of working out the MSI status, and that's also in the framework of some work that is of the grouping of the taxonomy that is ongoing in colorectal cancer.
Right. I was curious, is there a histologic pattern or, you know, pathologic pattern that makes you more suspicious that it might be MSI?
Yes, there is a histologic pattern. In patients with an MSI tumor, well, first of all, they are a bit more located on the right side in the colon.
Really?
Than in the left side. And the second thing is that if our pathologists look at that, you see clearly more inflammation and inflammatory cells, more lymphocytes. And pathologists sometimes can, let's say, suggest, not prove, but can suggest, yeah, you have to look really in the MSI status also in the framework of MSI maybe Lynch patients, but microsatellite instable tumors may be also sporadic tumors. And so we have regularly cases where our pathologists show the biopsies at our MDT board, multidisciplinary tumor board, that they suggest, yeah, it's really a lot of inflammation, a lot of lymphocytes. Look at the MSI status. This may well be an MSI tumor.
I'm going to get your take on some new drugs in development in colorectal cancer, beginning with the so-called triple angiokinase inhibitor, nintedanib, and what we know about it in colon cancer.
Nintedanib is a multi-target tyrosine kinase inhibitor, also with some similarities to regorafenib, but also some differences pharmacologically, but especially also on the different kinases, and which seems to have a better safety profile. There was a study that we published recently of nintedanib versus bevacizumab phase 2 study, where the safety toxicity was not an issue. What is being done right now is a clinical trial, large clinical trial, refractory patients, also many patients failing regorafenib, and then these patients were randomized between placebo ornithinentanib. Based on some of the difference in the mechanism of action, but also some similarities with regorafenib, the hope is there that in this group of patients with this type of design, there will be, although if there is a benefit, the benefit will be modest, but that there will be a benefit in survival so that after regorafenib, that some of the patients, we may still prolong the survival with nintedanib. The future then, if this trial is positive, that trial is called the LOOM trial. The results will be available at next year's 2016 oncology meetings. If that trial is positive, then of course, there may be another drug in the field of regorafenib, TAS-102, nintedanib, with probably minor difference in this, and there will be a play around safety, and the strategy will have to be worked out in the future.
So the last thing I want to ask you about is a paper you presented at the ASCO meeting, radiofrequency ablation combined with chemotherapy for unresectable colorectal liver mets. Can you comment on that?
The study that was presented this year at the ASCO meeting, the presenting author was Theo Ruurs from the Netherlands, was a CLOCK study. The CLOCK study was an ERTC study where patients with liver-limited metastatic colorectal cancer, so with metastasis only limited in the liver up to 10 metastases, were randomized in between chemo, FOLFOX in the beginning, and later on there was an amendment. Patients could also be treated with FOLFOX-BEV as control arm. And then the so-called experimental arm was patients chemo plus radiofrequency ablation of the liver metastasis. And we reported earlier in the past already some of the outcome results. At that moment, there was no difference in survival. But what we reported this year at ASCO with long-term follow-up, 8 years follow-up, is that the patients who received a multimodal treatment, so chemo plus radiofrequency ablation in this selected group of patients with liver-limited disease, that they had a longer survival, and the differences were quite striking. So what this tells us is that local regional treatments in well-selected patients, that you can initially control the disease also with chemotherapy, not the patients with aggressive biology, aggressive behavior, but that you can control that local regional treatment options such as radiofrequency ablation in the non-resectable patients, that that may further improve the outcome of patients. And that's always something that we have to look at, whether local regional strategy like radiofrequency ablation, and we at ASCO also interesting data on radioembolization in this topic, whether local regional therapies may improve the outcome for patients. And I believe that it may improve if we well select our patients. And that's what we're doing sometimes in patients not resectable. We start with chemo. If we can control or induce a response, but not yet becoming resectable, that we may then go for radiofrequency ablation in some of the patients to try to eradicate the tumor masses that are available in the liver. Of course, radiofrequency ablation you cannot do in all patients. They should not have 20 metastases. The metastasis should be smaller than 3 centimeters, so there are clearly selection parameters. This is not a good strategy for patients where you have some extrahepatic lymph nodes, so it should be really the selection of patients. And with a carefully selected group of patients, this may be an option. And this is also a topic that is being discussed in the ESMO consensus, the local regional treatment options, that for some patients, although the evidence is relatively low, we have very few randomized data of local regional treatments, but that's in all the armamentarium of our patients becoming a reality also.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the yttrium-90 and the SurfLock study, but can you kind of describe a clinical situation where you might use RFA in a patient with liver mets and a situation where you'd use yttrium-90?
We don't have data to say in which patients we should do yttrium-90 or which patients we should do radiofrequency ablation, but clinical differences may be the number of metastases. Patients with 15 metastases, that's too much to do radiofrequency ablation in this. However, we have also to state that the yttrium-90 radioembolization in first line, that's not a recommendation to go for our patients in first line. Today, the SurfLox trial was negative. There's a lot to be said about the endpoints that were used in the study. What the study, just to make that clear, looked at is patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. The mistake, to my opinion, that was done in the SurfLox trial methodologically is that there were quite a lot of patients with extrahepatic disease. 40% of patients had their primary tumor still in place, 40% of patients had extrahepatic metastasis. Local regional therapy is a treatment for patients with liver-limited disease. We should avoid to have many patients in this type of trials with extrahepatic disease. If you look, however, in the patients, in the subgroup of patients, or in the time of the tumor progression in the liver, that was clearly longer in patients who were treated with chemo plus yttrium 90 versus chemo alone. So that gives a clinical message that these treatments can be of potential value in the future for patients with liver-limited disease, not with a lot of extrahepatic disease, not with the primary tumor in place. Today, we do radioembolization in our center in later lines if patients still have liver-limited disease, not with extrahepatic disease. We have published a Belgium randomized study a couple years ago in patients later lines, patients with liver-limited disease, 5-FU continuous infusion versus 5-FU continuous infusion plus the SIRT, and the progression-free survival in these patients with the combination treatment was longer. So the message is there, I do think, is that local regional treatment is a treatment for patients with local regional disease, not with the extrahepatic disease.
What kind of side effects and complications have you observed, both with RFA as well as yttrium 90?
RFA side effects complications are not so frequent. In our center, we do it always laparoscopically because we don't do it percutaneously, but then there are the minor complications of laparoscopic surgery. Patient may, however, have, in theory, some pain after radiofrequency ablation, but the complication rate is low of radiofrequency ablation, but it is and remains a surgical intervention. Of the radioembolization with the SIRT spheres, there are some complications. They're not so frequent, but many patients have a couple of days more fatigue, nausea. You see in some patients after the radioembolization that the liver function is deteriorating. It's temporary, usually transient, but you see sometimes patients, and I've seen that also, where the bilirubin a couple days, the first week, the first 2 weeks after the radioembolization goes up, and then it normalizes again. And then, of course, if patients have hyperbilirubinemia and some liver function abnormalities, they feel a bit more tired, they have a bit anorexia, and sometimes a bit nauseous. At long term, there are complications described, and that's a concern when we implement that in first line. That may be a concern. At long term, we may see some kind of veno-occlusive disease with portal hypertension, esophageal varices, that I've seen two patients also at longer term. But on the other hand, we can say they have been lucky that they survived a longer period, but that's something that may happen. And occasionally, and that's the frequency is dependent on the experience, because you need very good dedicated team, a very good intervention radiologist. Occasionally you may see difficult to treat duodenal or gastric ulcers when some of the particles go to the stomach or to the duodenum. That should not happen frequent, but that happens, and that's being reported also.